യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനദോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. Now, during the last few sessions, we were discussing the process of controlling the vrittis, the nirodha, and we discussed the sutra, 12th sutra of the Samadhipada, that is, Abhyasa Vairagya Abhyam Tat Nirodha. The restriction of this misidentification of our sense of self with modifications is attained through repeated practice and through dispassion. We discussed this matter, and then in the 13th sutra, Patanjali gives a definition to this technique of abhyasa, repetition. And in the next sutra, he said, in the 14th sutra, that's all we have discussed earlier, this repetition, this practice should be continued dirghakala nairantarya satkara sevido dridhabhumi. So this practice to restrain the modification should be continued for a long time and without any break, with perfect continuity and a sense of respect and honor to the spiritual practice. In the 15th sutra, there is a definition of vairagyam, the highest dispassion, that is the total dispassion of the seeker, in whom the craving for earthly and heavenly pleasures is completely ceased. And then there is the discussion of asamprajnata samadhi and samprajnata samadhi. All these we refer to. Now please remember, we have been discussing samadhipada. So there's a technical point to be kept in mind. In the sutra text that you buy from the shops, the sequence of chapters is like this: first samadhipada, dealing with the highest concentration samadhi; second, the means to attain this samadhi, sadhanapada; third chapter deals with some of the consequences, the results, the byproducts of these spiritual practices, psychological, spiritual powers that accrue as a result of this practice. And the fourth chapter deals with liberation, Kaivalyapada. This is the sequence in the original text. Now, how this happened to be so is a different matter. Most probably, the great commentators who wrote commentaries on Patanjali's Yoga Sutra text must have organized this text this way. But there is another and apparently a much more practical way of organizing the text. If you do it that way, the first chapter will be the means we deals with, the spiritual practices that we should take up at the beginning of spiritual life. And then the next chapter deals with the consequences, the results of this practice. And third chapter deals with samadhi, and fourth chapter deals with the result of samadhi, which is liberation, which is supreme goal of yoga practice. Now, if you continue the samadhipada from this stage onwards, you will be dealing with many topics which you will understand properly only if you also study the second and the third chapters, because that's how it is organized. So we have to switch from this point, that is from the 15th sutra of first chapter, we have to switch over to the next chapter, that is sadhana pada. Sadhana means methods, how to go ahead in the spiritual path. So that's what we are going to do. Before we switch over to the sadhana pada, the next chapter, a few very important points from the standpoint of practical spiritual life I want to emphasize, and then we go to the sadhana pada, next chapter. First of all, what is vairagyam? Vairagyam is, in short, the ability to say no to sense pleasures. We have to pay a price for spiritual practice, spiritual enlightenment. We all pay a price for everything in this world. We don't get anything without paying a price. A price in terms of money, in terms of effort, in terms of sacrifices, in terms of strenuous, continued practice. So some price we had to pay. So the first price we had to pay when we take up spiritual life is to acquire the ability to say no to sense pleasures. And again, we all want freedom. Instead of giving complete freedom to the senses, we must be able to restrain this freedom in a creative and constructive manner, so that the energy that is conserved by restraining the senses can be used for spiritual practice. If we want peace of mind, we have to make a decision. And that decision is, we have to pay a price for it. And the price that we have to pay, if we want peace of mind, is the ability to see what is real and the ability to see, to recognize what is unreal, and the ability to recognize and accept certain unpleasant truths of our life, certain unsettling facts and truths. Now, what is the relevance in our own times? As I mentioned earlier, Patanjali says, abhyasa and vairagya, continued practice and dispassion, constitute the price we had to pay for getting peace of mind, for achieving yoga. This practice of dispassion is of four types, that is progressing, a progress in breaking the interconnecting link between our impulses, our memories, and our own activities. When impulses come, memories come, instinctive temptations come, we should be able to restrain our senses, restrain our mind. Now, here the question arises, can we restrain our senses? Can we restrain our mind? It is possible, but it is not easy at the beginning of spiritual life. So at the beginning of spiritual life, what we do, we purify, we sublimate, we refine the activities of the senses. We give a spiritual, a creative, a constructive, a productive orientation to our senses and mind. In fact, that is going to be discussed in the early sutras of sadhana pada, which the technically it is called kriya yoga, but we are coming to the subject before discussing different types of samadhis, asamprajnada and samprajnata samadhi, etc., it'd be much more logical and practical to discuss some of the early phases in the life of a yogi. So there are different types of dispassion. The beginning, the first stage of dispassion, which is nothing but an attitude. We learn from scriptures, we learn from lectures, we read books, and we come to understand that we have to practice dispassion. This is called yatamana, the beginning. And just I'm just going through this before we take up Kriya Yoga. The second stage is characterized by the attitude. But slowly our vasanas, tendencies, impressions, vrittis, they are slowly getting exhausted. We feel an onward movement. Well, if we can enjoy spiritual activities, meditation, reading of books on spiritual topics, listening to spiritual music, if we can enjoy, and if our mind tells us that this is a very productive, useful way of spending time, then we have reached this stage. Because many of the vrittis are exhausted, many new samskaras, creative samskaras, constructive samskaras, positive samskaras and vrittis are being created, which counterbalance the effect of negative samskaras. This is called the second stage, called Vyatirega. The third stage, we get concentrated. At this stage, we won't allow our senses to seek their objects. We are able to keep the attitude of a witness, the third stage called Ekendriya. And the last, Vairagya, dispassion, is called Vashikara. That is when we reach the highest stage of this dispassion. Now, after discussing this point, we have to begin this Sadhana Pada, which is called the second chapter. So I shall begin this, first of all. What are the important topics discussed in this second chapter? The first chapter that we discussed earlier, at least the 15 sutras of the first chapter, what is called Samadhipada, or the chapter dealing with highest concentration, is meant for spiritual seekers of a very high order, those who have a composed mind. So this high ideal is now presented by Patanjali. In the first 15 sutras of Samadhipada, he deals with the definition of yoga, yogaha chitta vritti nirodhaha. Every day, every moment, impulses, ideas, objects arise all around us. Our senses drag our mind towards these objects, and we identify ourselves with these objects. So we feel anxious, we feel exhausted, we feel happy, we feel unhappy, we lose our mental balance, we suffer from anxiety neurosis, we are worried about what will happen tomorrow. We are always drawn in between yesterday and tomorrow. That is a point that may need some elaboration. Can you imagine, really, is there such a thing as tomorrow or yesterday? Strictly speaking, there is neither tomorrow nor yesterday. The only thing that is real is the present. That's a reality. The past we experienced only as present. The future also we are going to experience only as present. Then is there such a thing as tomorrow, future, or past? But then, what happens in our daily life? For most part, our mind is always worrying about certain things that happened in the past. And mind is also worrying about certain things that we fear could happen tomorrow. Both are unreal. For a yogi, over the highest man of spiritual realization. There is neither tomorrow nor yesterday. It is an eternal present. Now, for such a person, there is no misidentification with the emerging vrittis all around. That's called the state of witness. If we can reach this highest state of witness sheep, then whatever happens around, we won't run away from, but we won't be swept off our feet by their force or influence. We won't be too anxious about what happens tomorrow, and we won't be too much worried about what happened yesterday, which means vrittis do not arise. When vrittis cease to exist, it is an eternal present, devoid of the past and also the future, neither yesterday nor tomorrow. This is the state of the highest samadhi state. And this is the state where there will be no vrittis, no misidentification. But again, this is a state to be achieved. At the beginning, this is not a reality for us. This is only a concept, an idea. Mentally, we think that is the goal to be achieved. Sometimes, I know this is being done in some meditation centers. People are asked to imagine that you have no problem. You imagine that you have no problem. You imagine that you are going to succeed. In certain cases, it works. In certain matters. But only a tiny percentage of problems can be solved that way. Permanently, the problem cannot be solved. The moment you come out of this session, very often, these problems re-emerge with greater force. There is a psychological principle which a bank executive told me way back 4 or 5 years back in India. A person who had attended this auto-suggestion, because he was a marketing executive, his performance was falling below the expected level, so his purpose was to improve his performance. So he, along with a group of other executives, underwent this program. So they had to, it's a 3-day program. They had to listen to ideas which are very positive. And they had to shout to themselves, well, I'm okay, I'm fine, I shall succeed. Like that, maybe 100 times they had to repeat again and again. And they had to tell themselves, and some loudspeakers also will shout at us, you have no problem, everything. Now, certain minor problems of anxiety can be not permanently remedied, but there will be some improvement, no doubt. But the problem is, the underlying problem is not solved. When you come out of the session, very often, the imagined feeling of serenity that you experience when you underwent this program, this session, becomes a source of trouble, because the problems re-emerge with greater force. Really, there is no greater force, but for some time you were relieved of or you were unaware of this problem. When the problem really emerges, it appears to be much more potent, much more serious. But people would tell you it had a result because they had paid maybe $1,000 for the session. And if you go and tell somebody, well, I paid for $1,000 for 3-day session and you didn't get any benefit, people call you a fool. But nobody wants to be called a fool. So they want to persuade themselves into believing that you had a wonderful effect. And this belief produces an effect. This is a psychological secret. They paid $1,000 for 3-day session, and really it was only an imaginary solution. When they come out of the session, they know at the back of their heart that nothing has really happened, but they don't want to announce it. But the money is lost, hard-earned money. So if they tell people, well, it was absolutely useless, they will be called fools. So, and also they want a worth for the money that's spent. So they pursue themselves into believing that they are now mentally quite relaxed. This is a secret behind many of these problems. Now, the real solution comes when our mind stops misidentifying itself with various experiences, setbacks, happy and unhappy events that take place all around us. At the same time, remain unaffected by these setbacks, unhappy events, still being able to act and work as usual. This is the sign of real mental serenity. That is a topic we are going to discuss in the second chapter of the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Please remember, the text that you get in the bookshops will have four chapters. The arrangement of the chapters is first Samadhipada on highest concentration. That's a topic. Then means for reaching that stage, that is Sadhanapada, second chapter. Third chapter deals with the Bhudipada, but the consequences, the supernatural powers or benefits of your yoga practice. And fourth chapter is Liberation Kaivalyapada, which is really the result of Samadhi. Now, logically, if you organize the chapters, these four chapters could be better and more logically organized this way. First, the means, Sadhanapada, then the results, benefits, Vibhudipada, third, Samadhi, the highest concentration, where vrittis are completely stopped, and fourth one is liberation, Kaivalyapada. So that's the order we are going to follow. But there is a reason why I dealt with the early chapters. Unless we understand our own mind, the working of the vrittis, the five levels of human mind, five levels of mental vagaries, as I said, you know, kshipta, mudha, vikshipta, egagra, niruddha. I discussed this earlier. All, the whole humanity can be divided psychologically into five categories. Those whose minds are kshipta, means highly restless, happiness, unhappiness, jealousy, envy, driven by all kinds of biological drives. Second stage is mudha, stupefied, infatuated by some undesirable tendencies. Both belong to very, very low level of human psyche. Third stage is vikshipta, where we are naturally in the midst of a conflict between good and bad, desirable and undesirable impulses and tendencies. Fourth stage is egagra, focusing on one positive tendency. And the fifth stage is the highest state of yoga niruddha state. So all these are discussed in the first 15 sutras of Samadhipada, including the definition of yoga, what it really means. Now, in the second chapter, we are going to deal with the real process of restraining and controlling the mind. So, tapa swadhyaya isharam pranidhanani kriya yoga. What is kriya yoga? Kriya yoga is nothing but tapaha, self-control, self-study, and self-surrender. To be very precise, this sutra recommends two very simple processes: Bhakti Yoga and Karma Yoga, Nishkama Karma. That's what the sutra really speaks about. Very simple. The relevance of this sutra is, it comes down to our level, then tells us, well, you are active all the time, mentally, intellectually, physically. You give a different new orientation to your action, thoughts, ideas, your day-to-day activities. Take a new perspective. If you take a new perspective, then instead of being in conflicts with our own self, being in the midst of anxieties and problems and worries, you can be always in a state of serenity of mind. And also, it tells you how to connect our personality to a higher transcendental spiritual level. Right now, we define ourselves as psychophysical mechanisms. Body is active, mind is active. Body is suffering, mind is becoming happy, unhappy, hungry, thirsty, miserable, and so on. It's all because we look upon ourselves only as psychophysical mechanisms. There is a higher spiritual dimension to a personality. And that dimension, spiritual dimension, we are in fact one absolute, all-pervading, ever-blissful, ever-serene Atman. Of that, the physical and psychological dimensions of our personality are only insignificant aspects. So we link ourselves to our true nature. We look beyond the psychological and physical dimension of personality. In fact, that is what is recommended here. So, there are different authors. According to some authors, this sutra deals with karma yoga. Kriya yoga means karma yoga. According to some other, Vijnana Bhikshu is one. According to him, this is nothing but karma yoga. In the Gita, there is a sloka. Arurukshor mune yogam karma karanam uchyate yogarudhasya tasyaiva shamakaranam uchyate. Spiritual seekers are divided into two categories. Those who are trying to enter the path of yoga and those who are fully established in yoga. Two categories. Arurukshu is a person who wants to take to a life of yoga, who wants to practice yoga. And Arudha is a person who is fully established in yoga. So, for those who want to attain yoga, action is the means. That's the literal meaning of Arurukshur Mune Yogam Karma Karanam Uchyate. Now, what is our true nature? As we find in our everyday life, what are we? Leave alone, forget the spiritual dimension. Apart from that, as we find ourselves in everyday life, we are psychophysical entities. We work, we think, we suffer, we enjoy at a physical level and a psychological level. So, mind and the five senses of perception are automatically active. There is no escape from it. Even if you sit quiet in an armchair, you are intensely active mentally. In the Gita, he says, Nekika Sikshanamabi Jadu Tishtati Akarmakrata Karedehi Avashakarma Sarva Pragdijaihi Gunaihi. Gita says, the third chapter. You cannot keep quiet even for one split second, physically and psychologically. Simultaneously, it's impossible. When we are physically active, we are physically active. When we are physically not active, mind is active. Thought currents, mental contemplations, all these are activities. So there is no escape from action. So what do? There are two ways. One, give a new orientation to our normal activities, a new perspective, a new attitude, then everything changes. So, according to a great yoga interpreter, commentator, called Vijnana Bhikshu, according to him, this Kriya Yoga actually denotes Karma Yoga. So it is a Patanjali Yoga Sutras, and Kriya Yoga is the first topic discussed in the second chapter of the text, Sadhana Pada. And there, this Kriya Yoga is described by the commentator, Vijnana Bhikshu, as Karma Yoga. That means, do your work, but don't worry about the results. He doesn't refer to a god. He says, he perhaps, you know, he was a Buddhist. Vijnana Bhikshu was a Buddhist. I have to remember, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra and also commentaries, there are many, many terms which are taken from Buddhist Yogacara philosophy. So all these many, many methods of meditations which are described in the commentaries all come from later Buddhist schools. Yoga Sutra as a text itself is much more ancient than Buddhism. But the commentaries were mostly written during the post-Buddhist period. So, Vijnana Bhikshu, being an agnostic, most of the Buddhist philosophers were agnostics, say that if you want psychological health, you practice Kriya Yoga. Kriya means action. Yoga means detachment, dispassion. So do your work, but practice dispassion. That's what he says. Now, according to another commentator, his name is Yoga Sudhagara. According to him, this means bhakti yoga, because there is one word, swa ishvara pranidhanani. Ishvara pranidhana means self-surrender to God, surrendering to God. Now, psychologically, the moment you feel, well, this is not my work, it is his work, even in normal life situation, you feel a great relaxation internally. We worry, we become anxious only when we are fully convinced that we are going to take the consequences of whatever we do. The moment we bring in another person who is going to enjoy or suffer the results of our actions, at that point, we feel relaxed. So, according to another, this is called famous commentator, the book is called Yoga Sutagara, it is called another commentary. He says, this is nothing but bhakti yoga, because it's mentioned here, tapaha, self-control. Tapa really means practice of fasting, certain vows that we take physically and mentally. When we take a strong decision, well, I won't eat today. Really, not eating today itself doesn't have anything spiritual about it. But you're denying your body something which it enjoys. So that involves another element. You are saying no to certain things, to something that your bodily craves, have a desire for. The moment you try to restrain your bodily needs and demands and wants, you transcend from the physical to the intellectual level. That's why great thinkers and philosophers, great masters of art, literature, philosophy, they could spend their time immersed in writing books, in drawing paints, composing music. They will not practice the regulations of eating and all other day-to-day activities as in military barracks. They won't do that. You have to remember one thing. Anybody who follows a military regimen cannot be great in any way, in the ordinary sense. You can easily imagine. What about the greatest music, the greatest painting, the great novel? Suppose you make a decision where tomorrow, every day, I write from 10 to 12 o'clock. You cannot be either an Einstein or a Dostoevsky or a Michelangelo. You can write a number of books, which may be all right, readable, but nothing very spectacular about it. Unless you forget your own personality and become identified with what you are doing, you cannot really make a great contribution, even in art, literature, philosophy, leave alone spirituality. Think of any of the great scientists of ancient early days, painters, musicians, composers, novelists. They completely forgot their physical needs to the extent of completely being immersed in what they were doing. So nature revealed some of its supreme secrets, and they became great writers, poets, thinkers, etc. So a strict military regime, a code of discipline, cannot make anybody really great. Suppose you sit for meditation. Well, I shall meditate from 7 to 8. If it's just exactly 8 o'clock, you should stop meditation. Such people will not be able to meditate very deeply, because they'll be very careful. They should not meditate beyond 8 o'clock. So, too much of discipline at a physical level cannot produce anything very spectacular. That's why, at one point, you should be able to transcend the body. Tell your body, well, I'm not giving you this. That is what is called tapaha. Tapa chittaigagriya manattapaha, it is stated here. One definition. The other definition is practice of vows, practice of fasting, silence, all these practices. I mean, saying no to some of our daily obsessive routine actions, activities, helps you to go beyond the physical level. See, silence. Silence also is a great discipline. But there are two types of maunam, you know. Mauna literally means contemplation. Deep contemplation is one aspect of real implication of mauna. So, mananat munihi, maunat munihi. So, deep contemplation is real silence. Contemplation of the higher truth. Otherwise, the mind will, you'll be silent, you won't be speaking anything. So, I know some people make a telephone call, oh, today I'm observing silence. So what are the news now? You ask questions. This sometimes we see this often. So mind is, or even if you don't physically speak, mind is full of thoughts and ideas. There also it is not silence. So real silence is silencing the thought process. And before we silence the thought process should be given a God word, a spiritual orientation. That is what is called tapaka. Swadhyaya means reading scriptures properly. One's own reading. Not out of compulsion. If you are going to write a thesis and you have to read some Upanishads or spiritual Bible, that will become swadhyaya. One's own effort with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. We read books which talk about, we teach about highest spiritual liberation, highest spiritual attainment, with meaning and contemplation. That is called swadhyaya. All these can be practiced if you practice karma yoga, but becomes much more easy if you practice bhakti yoga. Isvaram pranidhana means self-surrender. So, a feeling of surrendering to God. In fact, the concept of surrender in bhakti tradition, in devotional hari tradition, has got six important points, elements. So this is sloka which Ramanuja quotes, that is, anugulyasya sankalpaka pradigulyasya varjanam rakshasya dedi vishwasaka goptrutva varanam tatha atma niksheva karpanne sadvidha sharanagati. So what is prapatya sharanagati? First, give our mind a positive turn to a spiritual idea, spiritual life. So all thought currents that emerge in the mind should be positive and spiritually helpful. Because if we don't read books which speak and teach about spiritual ideas, and if we read novels and other thrillers, what happens? Mind will be always thinking about those ideas. So that's why reading is very important. Maybe in modern times it's much more important. So the first important point in self-surrender, bhakti yoga, is that one should fill his or her mind with positive, spiritually helpful thought currents and ideas. Second part is, we must avoid any negative or spiritually harmful thought currents. This is possible only if we feed our mind with positive ideas, positive thought currents. Mind is being fed every moment by the five senses which go out to the external world, bring ideas, images, visions, and concepts, and constantly feeding the mind with these ideas. So what we see should be good. What we hear should be good. What we talk about should be good. Because these are the ways by which we feed the mind with positive thought currents, positive ideas. That's why the swadhyaya is mentioned here. Swadhyaya means self-study. Study of spiritually helpful books. Maybe listening to lectures also can be some kind of a study. Even listening to radio talks on spiritual topics can be useful, because all these activities feed the mind with good food. If we eat bad food, we fall sick physically. If you feed the mind with dirty food, mind falls sick. So mind becomes victims of anxiety, neurosis, depression, all kinds of problems. So just as we take care of the body, we must take care of the mind also. That's why Swadhyaya and Ishwar Pranidhana, these are two important ideas which are connected to each other. So the second part is, we must avoid negative thought currents, and then a strong faith that God will protect us, and accepting God as the sole protector. See, we turn to God sometimes out of compulsion, but that itself is good. If God is gracious, then sometimes he will create a situation which compels us to turn towards him. If God doesn't care for us, then he will let, all right, you do whatever you want. So all problems are manifestations of God's grace. That's why a situation will be created in our life. Sometimes this forces us to turn to higher ideas. So I mentioned once sometime, there is a famous verse which comes in one of the devotion scriptures, maybe in Vishnu Purana, that is, yasya anugraham ichhami tasya vittam harameham bandhavaisha niyogena bhrisham bhavati dukkhitaka tena dukkhena samtapto yadimam na parityajet tam prasadam karishyami yad devairabhi sudurlabham. This is the verse. In fact, it can be put in the mouth of God in any religious tradition, because In all Christian mystical tradition you come across, great spiritual seekers going through different periods, long periods of trials and tribulations. In all mystical traditions, spiritual traditions. So the point is this, this grand idea is put in the mouth of God. Those whom I want to elevate to higher spiritual level, those whom I want to bless with spiritual illumination, I take away all their wealth. And I get that person completely isolated from his friends and his seeker fans, followers, so that he'll be forced to turn to God. And in spite of this miserable condition, he has become a pauper and is totally isolated. Still, if that person continues his search for spiritual growth, then as reward, I will elevate him to such a high position that he will become an envy of angels. Even angels will be jealous of him, because I will elevate him to such a high position of spiritual attainment. This is God's promise. So that's Gopurtha Varanam Tadha, the fourth part, the fourth aspect of self-surrender. And then we must have a sense of complete self-resignation to God and a total contempt for bodily sensory pleasures. If we can have this, then our whole life takes a new turn. And this, according to Patanjali, is the first creative step towards spiritual growth. So, same idea you find in another text, Kathopanishad, you find. There is a wonderful imagery. A person who has succeeded in restraining the senses, in saying no to sensory pleasures, is trying to liberate himself from the tyranny of the senses, the worldly pleasures, such a person will reach the goal. So life is compared to a journey in a chariot. Atmanam Ridhinam Viddhi, Shariram Radhameveja, Buddhidnu Saradhim Viddhi, Manapragrahameveja. You think of our life like a journey in a chariot. Horses are like senses. And then the path, the road is the sense objects. And then the reins with which the rider controls the horses is mind. The rider, the driver of the chariot, is intellect. And the owner, the resident, the one who is traveling the chariot, is ourselves. If we can control the horses with the help of a mind which is trained, then the horses will take the chariot through a safe route. If the horses are very strong, the mind is reins weak, mind is weak, or the chariot driver is incompetent, what happens? We may not reach the destination. The horses may take us over a precipice or may hit against a rock. So life will be lost if we don't control the senses and mind. Life becomes a spiritual journey to spiritual destination if we can train the mind properly so that it controls the horses and the horses take us along a safe route. This technique of taking the chariot through a safe route is what is meant here by the word Kriya Yoga, which is the first topic mentioned, definition and topic mentioned in the first sutra of Sadhanapada. So we'll continue the discussion in the next class. Thank you. Here, before we start our interaction, I should deal with one topic. There are a few letters, but one of our students, spiritual seekers who are some of them who are watching this program from outside, has written a letter. The question is this: it seems that cooling influences are what we want for the mind. What do they do for us? And if that's true, and since we are discussing the modification of samskaras, would you in some upcoming Friday talks mention what are cooling influences for the mind? Okay. Now, in fact, that's what we are discussing now. The mind right now, the mind may not be in a state of serenity and peace. Mind may be agitated, anxiety, neurosis, depression, full of conflicting thought currents and vrittis and modifications, fighting against each other. So mind becomes anxious, becomes agitated. So any kind of spiritual practice will have a cooling effect on the chittam, mental system, mind stuff. Any good action, prayer is one, meditation is one. Meditation may not be easy for people whose minds are naturally agitated. For such seekers, prayer is the most appropriate method. Prayer and contemplation. Prayer in solitude, not congregational prayer. Prayer in solitude with an attitude of complete resignation to God is the most most appropriate counter method to cool the agitated mind. And if it is appropriate, mention what influences might heat the mind so I can recognize and avoid this danger. I mentioned just now, any experience that agitates the mind, visual experience, seeing things, hearing things, any kind of audio, visual experiences, sensory experiences, any experience involving mind in any of the five senses of perception, eyes, ears, sense of smell, sense of touch, sense of taste, all these. If any of those experiences agitate the mind, bring a spiritually harmful tendency or impression or thought current to the mind, it will heat up the mind. It means it makes the mind more agitated. So that's the solution, that's the response to this question. So thank you. Now we'll have interaction. Before interaction, an important message. There will be no class next Friday, February the 20th, because we will be preparing for Sridharmakrishna's birthday the next day on Saturday. So please remember, next Saturday, February 21st, is Sridharmakrishna's birthday celebration. So all of you are welcome. And we'll be busy making preparations for this grand function on Friday. So there will be no class next Friday, February 20th. The class will continue on Friday, February the 27th. So any topic if you want to discuss? Okay. In fact, real karma yoga involves an element of bhakti. But I was referring to one particular commentator who happened to be a Buddhist who did not believe in a monotheistic God. So he doesn't mention that. But in actual practice, karma yoga becomes more easy and natural when combined with bhakti yoga. It becomes easy. All the great devotees are practitioners of karma yoga. And most of the great karma yogins you hear about, read about, were great devotees also. They complement each other. There is no contradiction between them.
Does Patanjali give specific antidotes for Shatripus, removal of Shatripus?
We'll discuss that. Kriya Yoga is the first step towards purifying the mind. We slowly take away Shatripus, six enemies. Madha Matsarya and all those things. Raga Dvesha, Madha Moha Matsarya. All these will be removed through the practice of devotion, as Ishwar Pranidhana mentioned here, plus total unselfishness. Bhakti or devotion is the antidote for removing all this. That's why when a person surrenders himself to God, a kind of resignation, from that moment onwards, all his actions get a Godward orientation, so all these Shatripus will be automatically removed. That's it. That is in the text proper. But samadhi is a state to be achieved by practice of the methods mentioned in the next chapter. But at the same time, some of the very important psychological points I mentioned earlier, the very rational and scientific analysis of human mind in its various aspects, study of vrittis and samskaras, which are very crucial in taking the first step in yoga text, yoga philosophy. They are all described in the early sutras of first chapter, Samadhipada. And then from 15 sutra onwards, it starts dealing with samadhi state, highest state, etc. Which is really mentioned in the second chapter, as the last of the Ashtanga Yoga. And Ashtanga Yoga is an important topic discussed in the Sadhanapada. But that comes in the first chapter itself. So for those who have not studied Patanjali's system of philosophy earlier without studying the sutras, it'd be difficult to follow.
So Ashtanga Yoga and Kriya Yoga, they're the same?
No, not same. Kriya Yoga is, Tapa, Swadhyaya, Ishwara Pranidhana. These three things together are called Kriya Yoga. And it is dealt with in the first sutra of second chapter. On the other hand, this Ashtanga Yoga is dealt with in the same chapter after some time. Yama Nema Asana Pranayama Pratyagara Dharana Dhyana Samadhi. The Ashtanga Yoga. That is also the topic discussed in the second chapter, Sadhanapada.
But if you have to do tapa, then you have to do Ashtanga Yoga? Otherwise, you cannot do tapa.
Well, tapa, tapa, at this stage, tapa means slowly saying no to the demands of body. That's why it is mentioned here, upavasa, fasting is mentioned. To transcend the body level, we have to take a strong stand when the body demands so many things. But pampering the body is the best way to get enslaved by the senses. So that's what is really happening. So yama and niyama, all these are possible only if one gets established in Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga is technically the first step towards restraining vrittis. See, in Kriya Yoga, what is done? Vrittis are given a higher spiritual orientation. Any more topic for discussion? So we will have class next February 27th, Friday. Please remember that. There will be no class next Friday, February 20th. Next class will be on Friday, February the 27th. Thank you.